Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today we're going to be looking at Blackmoor, Dave Arneson's rule supplement for D&D 50 years on now. We're going to see what stood the test of time and what was forgotten along the way. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into today's conversation, I will remind our viewers that, as always, at the end of the show, Dan and I will be hosting our After Party Chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server that is available to all our patrons. So you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, pledge at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get your Discord all set up, logged in, ready to go by the end of the show, and maybe about 10 to 15 minutes after the show is over, we will be there to chat with you all.
We love that. We just have the best patrons. For example, Backwius for checking in that we're currently live on Twitch and YouTube, which is fantastic. And, you know, Paul, I already see in the chat, you know, some people have read the Blackmoor supplement, the original D&D, and they're so excited to see us talk about their favorite rules. So many great things by Dave Arneson in this Blackmoor supplement that we're going to talk about today. So, you know, as we hit on the anniversaries that come by. Obviously, last year was the anniversary of original D&D itself being published. And then here we are in 2025, which marks the 50th anniversary of the first couple of supplements. We talked about Greyhawk a couple months ago. And the other thing that came out was the Blackmoor supplement. And to be clear, if people aren't familiar with this, there's almost no campaign information. This isn't a campaign setting book in either case. In some sense, this predates the idea that players would be interested in supplements about somebody else's campaign setting. So what it is largely optional rules that come out of Dave Arneson's famous Blackmoor campaign.
You know, it's worth noting that this is in line with the first supplement, which is, of course, called Greyhawk, which allegedly is all stuff that came out of Gygax's campaign. Although one would argue, you know, that is also not, right? Not campaign setting, right? It's all, like, extra rules, expansions, etc.
Exactly. And I guess
I got my copy here, Dan. I'm ready to go through it.
You're one up on me, Paul. I don't actually have a physical copy of Blackmoor, I'm ashamed to say. So I am looking at a digital copy in front of me right at the moment. So good on you.
I think I stumbled on this in a random auction at Gen Con one year.
Wow. Brilliant. It was probably a while ago because I'm guessing nowadays it would be like it would break my budget personally for what they're currently being sold for.
Yeah, I think it was like probably shortly after I bought my white box. I did pick up both Blackmoor and Greyhawk, and that's as far as my collectorism took me. I was like, that's enough. I feel like I have a good set of original edition books here. I don't need anything else.
Nice. I can bring my swords and spells over, which was actually the first ever original D&D book that I ever got. If it can survive the travel, frankly.
As I'm sifting through the pamphlets here in my original box, you know, just in case any viewers want to hear about this in a future episode, I of course also have my original print of Fluffy Quest. So, you know, look forward to the future episode on Fluffy. Go on, Dan.
We talked a little bit to Tim Kask in the past, who is listed as the editor of the Blackmoor supplement. And everything we know, it was a struggle. It was a struggle. There were notes. There were copious notes with many germs of ideas from Dave Arneson, I guess, that landed at the TSR offices.
I Isn't there a tale? I can't remember if Tim said this on our show or wrote it somewhere, but isn't there a story of like a basket, like a woven basket just full of loose notes that he had to sift through to try and, you know, bring order into this book finally happening?
I think Tim told us that. And the other thing I learned recently is I think that he was the second editor in line, is I believe that Brian Bloom was initially tasked with editing it. And he threw up his hands in despair and gave up, and then gave it to Tim Kask, who I think also threw up his hands in despair, but then just buckled down and got the job done sometime in mid 1975. So that's why we have this today. Let's dig into it. Let's dig into what's in the Blackmore supplement that you need. So first of all, some new character classes, and they had landed on the idea of people will buy new character classes. That's interesting. New options for your player characters. And they were clearly doing that in their campaigns. So pretty much any time a player stepped in and said, I want to do this different thing, Gary or Dave would go, here's a new class. Here's a brand new class from the get-go. So what you get in Blackmore for the first time is you get the Monks class and you get the Assassins class. Statted out. Mm-hmm. And yep. I have a couple of images. I don't know if that's, again, they're kind of text heavy, so please forgive me for pulling up this text heavy book that we're looking at. But there's you get a couple tables of the abilities statted out for the monk and the assassin here that we're looking at. And so this is a case where neither of them have spells per se, but what you do get is you get several pages of these custom unique abilities that show up at different levels that you have to keep track of, I guess I would say. One interesting thing is that monks here are a subclass of clerics. Monks are technically clerics here. Can't use any armor at all. But then as you advance, as most of us know, you kind of naturally just defend yourself better and you get a natural AC bonus. Your movement rate goes up. Initially, you can use very simple weapons and then you can attack with your bare hands successfully. You have a lot of thief abilities, opening locks, removing traps, listening, climbing, things like that. So there's actually technically you're cleric, but you've got a whole bunch of thief stuff.
You know, it's fascinating. You know, I can't help, right? I gotta do a little side by side comparison as I'm here poking through my Blackmore book and looking at Greyhawk, right? It's, you know, it's interesting to point out, right, that of course thieves didn't exist in the original edition of the game, and I was looking at like, well, what I know that thieves appear in Greyhawk, and I was wondering if other classes that are appearing there too. I think Paladin shows up here. What can we assume about whether or not Arneson was aware of the thief class being added to Greyhawk, right? Is this an alternate take on thief skills? Is this a logical follow on, or do you think these two things were developed in parallel? That's what I'm getting at.
I was like, that's a really easy answer. I'm like, well, that's interesting because, you know, Greyhawk just came out earlier the same year. So possibly this was Kask synthesizing the two, possibly. I never really thought about that before, but all this stuff clearly refers, you know, it's interesting because both these classes refer back to the Greyhawk thief. The monk has a whole bunch of abilities. The assassin is a thief subclass. But yeah, maybe Kask was editing that in to make that coherent actually.
Yeah, that's what I wonder about, right? Right? Is that you know, without asking Tim, who probably doesn't remember himself, I don't know how we'll ever solve that particular mystery. But it's just a thought that entered my brain of like, oh, I wonder if, you know, if this is an adaptation. I mean, clearly, you're right. The text, as written, mentions the thief specifically. Right? Refers back to the thief. How far apart were these books? I wonder. This is September 75, and Greyhawk we're getting in. Oh gosh, my printing is very late. I don't know when it originally came out. Wait, February of 75 is the date on the forward.
Yeah.
It's not that far off, you know. I don't know.
Yeah. You're right. I see in the chat, Hobo Ogre is asking, what cleric powers does the monk have in that edition? And the answer is basically nothing. The answer is basically nothing. They have the same hit dice. They have the same saving throws. Mm. They have the same attack rate. Can't wear armor, different weapons, can't turn undead, no spells, nothing. So, as many of us know, in first edition AD&D, the monk isn't a subclass of cleric. They're uniquely their own thing that's not a subclass of the main the main four, fighter, magic user, cleric, thief. Which kind of marks this as like an oddball. It's an unusually oddball class. Great question. Yeah. Yeah. How many monks have you had in your games, Paul?
There was that one in the game that we were playing when we first started playing together.
Right.
Right. It's the one.
Was that made under second edition?
Yeah, I think it was made under second edition. Yeah.
Was that? Got it.
I got to admit, these are not my favorite class additions here. These are not classes that I want to lean into and put into my campaign very much at all. Monks always struck me as very weird, right? They're clearly watching a lot of kung fu movies, and we're like, yeah, let's have that in D&D too.
Yeah.
And the assassin, and I think we've covered the assassin, right? We've talked a lot. Did we have a whole episode about assassins, maybe? I can't remember.
I think so. Yeah. I think so.
The assassin also strikes me, whereas monk is just weird, I think assassin leans into that area of like, does this need a class or is this just something you should do? Right. There's that classic story I always love to talk about with the person who was running or the original, just straight Three Little Brown Books, and had somebody who was like, oh, I really want to play a thief. And their response was, oh, there's no thieves in this edition. You know, but if you want to be a thief, steal something. Right. I feel like if you want to be an assassin, kill people. I don't need special rules for that.
Exactly.
Especially the rules that we get, right? The rules that we get are so odd. They take the action away from the table, right? They obfuscate everything is abstracted into these weird tables. I don't know.
I will say, I agree with you 90% of all this. I've never had a player make a monk while I was DMing, frankly. I also am not super fond of this business of like, you don't need armor. It doesn't, to my mind, it doesn't quite fit with our European medieval plate mail knights kind of thing. And you saying that you can punch through my plate mail is not my favorite thing either. I will say I have a slightly warmer spot for the assassin, or at least what we're looking at right here for the table, because, and actually this lower table that we're looking at is one of the top things I might actually use from the Blackmoor supplement, because the Little Brown Books have the option for a player character to hire an assassin and send them after some opposing domain lord. And there's no rules for handling that. So what you do get here, at least, is some rules by Arneson of when the assassin NPC gets hired, how do you determine whether it worked or not? And that's this lower table here, which, at least to my reading, is clearly for the off-screen mission of the NPC assassin that you hired, which to me kind of makes sense, and I would be personally happy to use it. Now, the very weird thing is that when you move forward to first edition AD&D, that same table appears, but now it's interpreted as a special melee attack that only assassins get in a fight. And when I personally read that as a young person in AD&D, I was like, what are you talking about? There's a class that has like an instant kill attack with a percentage base to it. What are you saying? But in the original appearance, it makes a lot more sense to me. It's like, how do you determine whether the NPC off screen succeeded or not? And I would actually use that table here. That's one I don't mind that additional detail to.
I wouldn't use it.
I hear that. I hear that. Because you just wouldn't allow player characters to hire assassins in the first place, or you would want to play it out in detail?
Yeah, I would, you know, first of all, I can't imagine it'd be so prevalent in my game that I need a table for it, right? Like, I would think this is a once or twice in a campaign kind of thing, right? No. Why do I need a whole table for it? I could grant you, okay, maybe your campaign goes in a certain direction where you get into more domain building kind of stuff, and your players are becoming more armchair generals, which I understand is sort of where the game was going at this point, right? So I see how they got there. I've never, like, again, I think you and I have found this, right? Like, that even though the rules were written, right, we have a lot of artifacts about this is the progression of D&D. When we've tried to emulate it, I've always been like, you just totally changed the game into something I don't particularly like. I want to play the adventure game, not this weird domain management game.
Yeah.
So anyway, okay, that's a lot of words. I would think, A, I would hope it's incredibly rare, and then so B, I would probably just customize it, right, on the fly. I would either say, great, let's play it out, right? Let's, you know, you role play as the assassin. I'm going to set up a whole adventure for them. Let's do it.
Yeah.
You know, or you know, and you probably shirk at this one though, but maybe I might, like, depending on how important the assassination is, right, I might just have its success chance dictated by the demands of the plot of the game I am running. As in, I would probably just fiat it. I would say, great, here's what happens. I would make a choice. And I would probably turn it into a hook for an adventure, right? The answer would probably be neither complete success nor complete failure. I would probably almost always rule it as, well, something interesting happened. There you go, and then roll that into the adventure. Again, all this stuff is, I'm super gray area DMing, right? This is, we really get into the area where I'm like,
I'm considering
the world and the plot of what we've built together so far, and I'm just trying to make big picture choices. I wouldn't want it to be ruled by one die. That's the gist of what I'm trying to say.
I forgive you. but reasonable, and I tend to actually do want it some more mechanics for guidance, but.
How many assassin player characters have you had in your games, Dan?
I think I've had one. I think I did have one playing AD&D. Someone did that. And that campaign was wonky for a lot of other reasons.
I once played in a game where I played a character who was an assassin, by which I mean I played a character who was a magic user thief who killed people.
Okay.
For money.
Yeah.
And nothing to do with any official assassin role. It was just the nature of the character.
Okay. So, Paul, maybe you don't like these two classes. Maybe the monk and the assassin are not
particularly
your
fond of them.
Let's go on. And you want to do more dungeon crawly type stuff. Perfectly fine.
Yeah,
let's go on to the next section and see if this helps you out. So, the next section is a brand new system. And maybe bring up the orange dot image there. A brand new system for additional detail in your D&D melee combat that gives hit locations during melee. So what you get here is every single creature that you possibly fight has to be identified as either humanoid, reptile, avian, insectoid, snakey, something else on different pages. And then your total hit points get divided up into different body parts on a percentage basis. So maybe your head is like 15% of your hit points and your torso is 20% and each arm is 10% and your legs are 15%, something like that. And so for every melee hit somebody takes, then you get to roll a d20, determine a hit. Then you look at these charts, you roll percentile dice and look at whether you're attacking the front, the side, or the rear. That determines whether you hit them in the head or the chest or the torso or the arm or the leg. And then you go and you deduct the hit points from that part. And then when a particular part gets degraded or zeroed out, they lose usage of that limb, that part. Now, if your head gets zeroed out, you're automatically dead. And then there's some additional rules for, you know, your movement degrades and you're bleeding out and additional hit points. And then there's also an additional table for relative height of the attacker defender, right? So if you're 6 feet tall and I'm 5 feet tall, then I only have a lower percentage to be able to hit you in the head and more likely to hit you in the legs or something like that. Mwah! right? It's refined, detailed hit location system for D&D melee combat. There's your additional focus, Paul, on the dungeon experience. How do you like that?
Viewers, we all know Dan is beating me. We can all hear it coming. Like this, we know what's happening here. Yeah. I'm gonna twist this, Dan, because I'm concerned in this episode that I'm just gonna be a super negative Nelly through this whole episode. Let me say this. I use a hit location table, Dan, in my D&D games all the time.
Okay.
It's not this one.
But only when people hit zero hit points, right? Right.
Yeah, and really, frankly, it's kind of more cribbed from Warhammer Fantasy 2nd Edition than anything else, which I think did this in a very interesting way. Right? Warhammer 2nd Edition did have hit locations. It was nice that it wasn't a separate roll. You just invert your rogue percentile dice. You just invert the percentiles to read where the hit location is. They had armor, right? You had separate pieces of armor that you bought per body location. So that's, I guess that gives you a little more knob tuning for your equipment. That's kind of interesting, I guess. Yeah. But then most importantly, most interesting in Warhammer 2nd Edition is when you get to the point of doing critical hits, which is like the biggest, craziest thing you can do. Now the hit location matters. Now we're going on to charts to find out what cool thing happens or what crazy thing cool if you're on the receiving end, what crazy thing happens. And that's how I use it. So I have... I think we've talked about this in the past. I have a critical hit system so that's just used as my personal version of finding some kind of buffer to put between zero hit points and death. So, yes, no, I absolutely splitting up your hit points across body parts. Ah, come on. No. That's crazy. What I do is, the hit point is just a hit point pool. And then once you get to zero, we roll on a critical hit chart, which includes the location and the severity. So I like that because it gives a little flavor to the combat of something interesting that happened to you. You broke your arm, you sprained your wrist, you got your face severed, whatever it is. And it is a real result on the table. Yep. and then once you're at that level, now next hit is death. And that's the major thing that I'm trying to accomplish there, is just to give a little bit of a buffer, a little bit of emergency warning of like, hey, player, you're in trouble. You really should think about not being in combat if that's possible, which I think is the major thing that's missing for me in just a straight hit points to zero death. Is there's that, it's very difficult to sense that moment of, oh, am I imperiled? Am I about to die? Right? Like, we kind of know that when you're like, oh, I've got one hit point left. Sure. Yeah. What about when you have 3 hit points or 4 hit points or 6 hit points? Like, where is the critical level of danger where you're like, oh, next hit's gonna kill me? Especially at higher levels, it's hard to see. So that's why I like my critical. Okay, that's enough about my critical system, but just want to call out that, like, I don't hate location chip tables. Don't hate them. And there's a lot of different ways to do them. This one is fine, and I actually do appreciate that he's broken it apart by body type. Because it is weird. Most Warhammer 2nd Edition tables get weird when you're like, I'm fighting a winged serpent, right? Like, I don't know. What does it mean? You can't get in the right arm. What does that mean? Yeah.
Many people overlook that. You're right. Many people go to make a system like this, only think about people fighting people, actually overlook that. Mm-hmm. That actually was one that he was actually thinking ahead on. You're reminding me that I also, for a while, used some critical hit charts in my game that indicated particular hit locations. And by critical hit, I mean you hit a natural 20 or something like that. Discarded it because it felt too punitive to the PCs over time. So neither one of us have ever gone down the path of adding multiple die rolls to every attack. So we've never... To me, that just seems a bridge too far to multiply the number of die rolls for every single attack.
I have somewhere in my collection, I have a large D12 where each face of the D12 is the name of a location, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so I've toyed with that, and that is, it could be a little fun because then you can just add that to your fistful of dice, right? I'm rolling my attack and I'm throwing the hit location die in there with it. That's cute. I don't know, I've done that, but not a ton. Yeah.
I have the exact same die and I've done the exact same thing. And then
I will say that's like one of the downsides of the critical system I have is that my tables are very deep. There's a lot of entries. So the player has to just roll the die, and then they're just looking at mystery numbers and waiting for me to dictate their outcome. I do like it would be nice, frankly, if I could get like a custom D8 that has the severities on it and just hand them that pair of dice and here you go. Roll the location and severity.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Then it's a little more in your hands. That would be fun.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. That's not terrible.
That's a thought for me to someday look into.
There's, you know, I'm not a big fan generally of like needing to do table lookups during the game, particularly during a melee combat. Slows it down too much. I could imagine, right, and I tried this to have like a particular, maybe your critical hit chart, something like that. One or two things that are important enough, you put it on your DM screen and it's directly in your field of vision when the time comes. But arbitrarily expanding table lookups is something I'm really not super fond of.
I agree. I don't mind the slowdown because this is a major moment. This is a very exciting moment, so I don't mind a little slowdown there.
Yeah,
I'll say it is the one and only, I think, personally important thing in my DM screen. And I have that right in front of me.
Yeah. And that's what I was doing at the same time. Yeah, that's what I was doing at the same time.
Yeah. Anyway, we've gone down a weird alley. Yeah, go on.
For core D&D, right, this was an idea that just withered and died. So this was not in the Arneson's hit location system was not in any later edition. And in the first edition AD&D DM's Guide, as you begin the combat section, there's kind of a multi-paragraph diatribe by Gygax that you definitely shouldn't do any crazy thing like hit locations in D&D. So this was one where the two creators clearly disagreed. And you know what I'll say? I'm glad it was tried. I'm glad that they were experimenting. When I was at Papyrus Racing, where we did racing simulations, we spoke to a NASCAR racer named Bobby Labonte. And one thing that he said to us with the idea of like, would I hire another driver or something like that? He said, you know what? Once in a while, you got to put one on the wall. You gotta put your race car in the wall once in a while. Otherwise, you're not really trying. And I feel like this is an example where Arneson was trying something experimental, did not become core to D&D. And the other thing I will say, because the first time I read this, I was like, well, this is just raving lunatic madness. but I'll say that later on in his first fantasy campaign, what he said is, well, we would trot those rules out for like a boss fight. For like a key highlight supervillain boss fight or like a one-on-one duel, we'd zoom in more and we'd use these rules in that kind of situation. I'm like, oh, why? I mean, that begins to make sense to me. And if you just justified that in Blackmoor with sometimes we will use this to give additional detail to important fights, that starts to become understandable to me, actually. But that little detail about how we're going to use it occasionally is not in the Blackmoor book.
All right, shall we move on to the next section?
Okay, well, maybe you don't like another hit location for every single attack roll. So maybe the next section will make you happier.
Yeah, okay. Go on.
Maybe this is what we're looking for. So the monsters, a new list of monsters, right? Everybody loves new monsters. Mm-hmm. So you get a new, roster of, well, they're sort of new, because frankly, a lot of them are already in the Little Brown Books, actually, in Volume 3, the DM's Guide. And what you see here, I don't know if you want to pull up the monster list, Paul, to look at on screen. So they're almost all aquatic monsters. So the Blackmoor book is very water themed, very aquatic-y, watery themed. And the entire roster of new monsters are all, thank you for that. So we're looking at here, the new monsters in Blackmoor, and they're pretty much all aquatic. Some of them were already referenced in the last couple pages of Little Brown Books where they said, oh, you want to do water stuff here? You can do this with the mermen and aquatic elves and giant crabs and stuff like that. So some of these are, I guess, being refined or rewritten or given additional detail, I guess. And then some of them are brand new. So you have a whole bunch of giant animal-y types, crabs, octopus, giant squid, giant crocodile, giant toad, giant frog are super thematic to Blackmore and, you know, people that we know that work in this space.
All right, Dan, I'm going to give you a real quick mini game here, right? Because I find this very telling about the list of monsters. Please. I'm going to quickly leaf through my book here and show the spot illustrations we get for the monsters. And you tell me if they do or do not appear in this book. So the first one, Hellhounds. Hellhounds, are they
do
here?
Not appear in this book. Those were detailed in Greyhawk. Right. Not appearing in this book.
Umber Hulk.
Not appearing in this book. Those are from Greyhawk.
Okay. Not labeled, but I'm going to say that's a merman, maybe?
I believe that's a Sahuagin. I think that's a Sahuagin. They reuse that image in the Monster Manual for Sahuagin. That is in this book.
Oh, okay. All right. We got one.
Yes. This one, Harpy. Well, we got one. Harpy, not in this book. That's in the original Little Brown books.
Finally, you get two here at the end. You get the Mind Flayer and the Roper.
Oh, the Mind Flayer and Roper. Not in this book. They appeared in the Strategic Reviews, number 1 and 2.
So 1 out of 6.
What about the Chimera at the back, Paul? What about the Chimera on the last page?
There you go. Chimera.
Right? Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. Not in this book. That's in the original Little Brown books.
Okay. Well, what happened? Yeah, did the artists not read the book?
No, they didn't. I mean, that's probably Tim Gask struggling through multiple baskets of like, well, we have these rules and we have these illustrations and look, I made a book.
But the telling thing for me though is, imagine you're an artist, you're an OD&D artist, and you're like, hey, we need some spot illustrations. Find cool monsters and make us some illustrations. And you're looking at this list. Oh boy, do I want to draw a Portuguese man of war? Do I want to draw a? How do I even say that? Forget it. I'm going to draw another Hulk.
Oh, the Azitzakibble. The Azitzakibble. Now, Paul, I thought that you would be a big fan of the Azitzakibble because they're underwater, intelligent manta ray creatures, all of whom are chaotic philosophers. Which is a fancy way of saying they're all clerics, and one in ten of them are vampires. 10% of all the 10% of and they're like random level from like 1 to 11, and I think 10% of them are all vampires. So Paul, aren't you excited now to bring in the chaotic philosopher manta ray vampire creatures into your campaign?
That's great. I can finally make my D&D adventure based on the hit movie Sharkula. Awesome.
Ooh, with real with movie. Pointy fangs.
Real movie, it exists.
The Azitzakibble is so friggin' mad. That there are days I really and I've never used an Azitzakibble in my campaign. Maybe I'm a bad person.
I gotta say I'm not thrilled with this list of monsters, Dan. It just I don't need now
okay, so two things.
Let's be kind. Again, I want to be kind. Minotaur? Yeah. That's a classic. Yeah. Great. I need stats for a Minotaur. Hell yeah. Let's get that in there.
No, that's not a Minotaur. It's a Minotaur lizard, Paul.
God damn it.
Minotaurs are in the original books. This is a special type of giant lizard that jabs you with its horns.
Oh, well, I tried.
I'm sorry. You got giant lizards, you got fire lizards, you got minotaur lizards. Okay, fire beetles. Okay, he's got a bunch of giant beetles, and one of them is the fire beetle, and the fire beetle is a classic. The one hit die beetle that you run into on the first level of the dungeon that lights it up for you if you grab their like glowing gland. That's a nice piece of creation. Yeah.
Every player loves to steal the glowing gland off the fire beetle. Which I think, unfortunately, always is a slightly more disappointing of a treasure than like sounds really cool in the moment, and then you're like, "What? I guess it's like a flashlight." Okay, well, that's still it's useful. That's nice. Yeah.
Now, I credit where it's due. It's been said that most of these aquatic monsters were created by Steve Marsh. That's what Gary says in the preface to the Monster Manual. Is that these are mostly Steve Marsh creations. The Sahuagin is interesting, that it's the first time you get a monster with like two pages of backstory. It's the first time where somebody went loopy with like, oh, this is so interesting. I'm going to give you a culture. I'm going to give you a backstory. I'm going to give you a biosphere, religion. And you, instead of just like a couple lines, you get two pages of information about what the Sahuagin are like. So clearly, Steve kind of adored that particular little piece of creation. One thing I got to say is that in many cases, the size and the damage for these monsters is completely game-breaking. So, for example, like you mentioned, the Portuguese Man-O-War has 100 attacks. It's got 100 tentacles, so it can attack you with up to 100 attacks in a melee round.
I thought the carrion crawler was rough. Jeez.
Right. And the whale, I mean, okay, whales are big, but the whale has a 10 to 80 hit point bite, and if it hits you with its tail, it does 15d10 of damage, 15d10, so between 15 and 150 points of damage. The dinosaurs, like the Mosasaur and the Plesiosaur, are doing up to 48 points or up to 80 hit points of damage. And the beetles are doing ridiculous amounts of damage too. So I feel like they're completely, you know, just a couple months ago, every monster did 1d6 damage. And then that was changed in Greyhawk, and then these Blackmoor monsters are just more hit points than any PC is supposed to have at this point. And that's, I feel like if I'm going to use them, I have to go in and tweak them back into kind of scale with the rest of D&D, because I think they're completely out of scale, frankly, in many cases.
That's rough. All right. Can we move on? Can we stop making fun of these monsters?
Well, maybe the monsters. Like, okay, so maybe you're not using these monsters underwater a whole lot. Maybe the next section.
Yeah, we're at the staples in the book here, so we're halfway through.
Okay, you're about to see the first like official D&D dungeon, right? The first officially published, you know, by TSR D&D dungeon, the Temple of the Frog, the famous Temple of the Frog by Dave Arneson, which was part of his campaign. This is given some amount of detail for pages and pages.
This is worth talking about, right? Because this isn't a thing that they had really figured out yet, right? They had not figured out the print that the players actually wanted printed, you know, keyed location adventures. And this really is kind of the first one that we're ever going to see, right? Like, I know a lot of people will call out, like, oh, the Palace of the Vampire Queen was really, like, you know, the first printed separate D&D module. It's true. But I think, as I'm looking it up on the KEM, that actually comes after this. The Blackmoor beat them to the punch. Yep. But granted, it's a part of a larger supplement. But still, like, this is a first. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Now that said, so you know, as fans of the show know, I am a big fan of Fear of a Black Dragon, another podcast, highly recommend it. And I recently listened to them reviewing the first ever dungeon printed in the Dungeon Magazine. It was Dungeon Magazine issue number one, the very first dungeon to appear in there. They reviewed it. And I was just laughing because they were making the same point as me here. They were saying, like, you know, it's noteworthy. It's the first one, right? It's the first. In this magazine had kind of a different Viewpoint, then our classic like Dragon magazine. This is the very first one that's noteworthy. And that's about all the nice things they had to say about that adventure. Thereafter, it was like, yeah, it's fine. It's an adventure, I guess. It has a few cool things in it, I suppose. And that's kind of my takeaway from the Temple of the Frog, to be honest. First of all, wow, is it wordy. These are long entries, Dan. This is a lot of text.
Yes, I agree. I agree.
And these are the tiniest maps in the world. I need my magnifying glass to find the need numbers in some of these maps. But I get that. That probably makes sense. I'm willing to bet these maps were probably full 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper maps that have been reduced to fit in their book.
Yeah. Good. Yep. You're right.
That must be why these maps.
I have the first dungeon level as a prepared image that might be interesting to look at. And if Paul can find that, you get there's this temple in a swamp. And there's a town around it, and you have a couple maps of the above level structures. And then here we're looking at the first level, the first of two levels of a dungeon. And the style is similar to what we see in Castle Blackmoor, like in First Fantasy Campaign, and similar to the Lost Dungeons of Tanisborg. Is the Blackmoor guys, they like to use a lot of diagonals. They're not using every single space, but there's a lot of diagonals they'd like to use like this. And so if you look real, and I know this is very small to everybody, but if you look real closely, this first level dungeon, there's a lot of rooms that say barracks. And it says barracks and then a little number in parentheses. So it says barracks 150 or barracks 100, main barracks 250, barracks, 50 or 150 and stuff like that. And so to be clear, that number in parentheses is the number of troops stationed there. So the rooms have 50 or 100 or 200 or 250 enemies per room that you're expected to dungeon crawl through. Yeah. So I'm not even sure that fits. I'm not even sure that physically fits in the space. But we're clearly in a situation where we were doing wargaming. We have sweep attacks on the table. We're accustomed to having, orcs show up in numbers of, 200 or 300 or something like that. And part of the game is that you high-level Conan types are going to be fireballing and sweep attacking through potentially hundreds of low-level enemies. And that's pretty much what you get on this level of the dungeon. There aren't a lot of puzzles. There aren't tricks or traps. It's like, okay, how would you set up? I guess your big temple complex to guard it properly, and you get hundreds and hundreds of first level troops, and that's the game.
And what about this whole ring system? Did you read through that?
I looked at the chart.
Table of rings and one ring that rules the other. That's sounding vaguely Tolkien-esque. The commander's ring and the officer's ring and the sergeant's ring. And they give complete control over killer frogs and frogmen.
Yeah.
Is that that's a little puzzly, right? Like if I can figure out the ring structure, I get the right ring, I can order these people around. And then now I have my own troops. And now we're really playing a war game, aren't we?
Yeah. Good point. And when you get to, if you go another level down here and you get into that frog pond, there are, I believe, 1,200 killer frogs in the frog pond on the next level down.
Yes.
So have fun with that, kids. Now, a little bit of backstory, right? So this was, the whole Temple of the Frog was developed in play. You have about two pages just detailing the commander. The high priest, who's someone who's come in and absconded with this position, a character named Stephen the Rock. And so Stephen the Rock, to my understanding, in the Blackmoor campaign, was played by one of Arneson's players, Stephen Rockford, who many of his friends called Rocky or the Rock. So we're in a state where frequently your player character name is probably your name, right? So okay. Stephen Rockford's playing Stephen the Rock. And supposedly Arneson came to him and actually asked him to make a villain type character and develop it and play it in Blackmore as a foil to the other player characters. And so the backstory of Stephen LaRocque, and this is another place where you get one of these sci-fi injections, is that Stephen LaRocque came from a different world. And the backstory is basically evil Star Trek. So we've got your Star Trek without the Prime Directive. Someone came down, has a bunch of science fiction elements giving them extra power. Stephen wears bat-powered battle armor that's like the top level, the best magic plate mail, and he can shoot lasers out of his sword and on all kind. It has a med kit that just will heal him, heal any damage at all. And he has to report back to an orbiting satellite every month secretly. And so you get this long, elaborate story about the backstory of Stephen LaRocque and all of his powers and all of his equipment. And he's basically pretty much impossible for anybody to beat because there was actually a player character running him who cared about all this stuff and detailed right. all the copious defenses of the Temple of the Frog. Which is a different way of setting up an adventure. Like an actual yep. opposition who actually designed it. And that's basically what you get.
That is fascinating, right? That almost feels like one extra layer beyond what we did with the Big Bad, right? You got an adversary. That's awesome. You got a player yep. controlling the adversary. Yep. Fantastic. Yep. But they're actually playing with their own set of rules that modulate like what they're able to do and what things they can get, presumably. I guess that's kind of cool.
I can see that.
Neat idea.
I can see it.
I don't hate it.
This particular adventure, I don't know how I would personally use it. Like I like going back to classic adventures and playtesting them again. And I can't say this is one that thought has occurred to me because I'm not sure. Just mowing down hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of soldiers and killer frogs one after the other is not something I'm wrapping my head around is what's going to be a really great play experience. I don't even know what level of characters I would need to make that feasible the way it's set up.
Good point. Doesn't really tell us, does it? Here's the adventure. Good luck. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost like it's not meant to be beaten. It's set up to defend this NPC, frankly, and it's arguably just not set up as a thing to be beaten. Maybe I'm misreading it, but
Well, Dan, we have 10 minutes left in the show, and there's a little bit of text still at the back of this book. Maybe in the last couple of pages we'll get saved here with some really high value element here in the Blackmore book.
So the last three things are: you have a page of rules for underwater adventuring, which are
seems reasonable intricate. When you've got all these underwater monsters. Yep.
You have a couple pages on sages, like really detailed, like make a sage. What do they know? What's their knowledge? What's their chance to know something? How much do they cost? You automatically become chaotic if you kill a sage. The last two paragraphs are wild. The last two paragraphs about sages are like, boy, that was a different day of design. Anyway, I've never used a sage, so I don't know. There's a sages guild, and if you fire a sage, the guild won't let you hire another one. And then if you kill a sage, you're automatically chaotic, and they also curse you. It's a different way of looking at things. And then the very last thing in the book are diseases. And I have wanted, again, okay, plus one for using real world names of diseases and trying to give them detail in your game. I think you've dealt with this kind of thing in Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, Paul. I actually have wanted to use this. I kind of appreciate this kind of real world grit. And when I've tried to use these rules, they don't work super well. You catch a disease and there's just a flat percentage that you die. It doesn't have anything to do with your level, your hit points, your abilities or anything like that. And then if you don't instantly die, what it does is it saps your strength ability. Not your hit points, not your level, not your dexterity. Just like for some reason they were hyper focused on the strength ability as the be all end all. And when I, you know, having tried to use these a couple times, I wind up, you know, rather massively rewriting the rules of what happens when you get a disease. So I get the intent. I like having real world flavor more than what they did in later editions, which was either abstract or all make believe. But in practice, the mechanics don't work super well in my experience.
Dan, this is not looking good for the usability of Blackmore. Old school campaigns, I have to say. The funny thing was, I was having a conversation with my partner earlier today, who was asking me about what our topic was, and I was like, I'm a little worried about this one. We're going to talk about Blackmore. I've skimmed through it. I'm worried that all of my responses are going to be, not for me, wouldn't use it. And I thought either this is going to be a very spicy conversation because Dan's going to be pushing me on like, this element or that element's great. Or
I did.
Dan's just going to completely agree with me and this is going to be the shortest episode ever.
The Greyhawk supplement, I'll use about half of it. I feel like there were mistakes in Greyhawk, and I feel like I can use about half of the content. And with Blackmore, it's clearly less. Many of the things did not survive, were not sustainable as great elements of D&D. There's not a lot, you don't have, sages aren't an important thing in D&D today, neither are diseases. Neither are many of the, many of these people still don't know some of these aquatic monsters that show up, like Azitzakiddle and Morkoths and Mashards and stuff like that, aren't really beloved. So, I don't know, was it given proper treatment by the people at TSR when Arneson gave his notes out? Is the responsibility to Arneson to polish these things better? I don't know.
Yeah. I am. I will say, like, the collector in me is pleased to have a copy of this book in my little white box here, along with the three LBBs and my copy of Greyhawk and my original, or not original, I don't know what this is, fourth or fifth print of Palace of the Vampire Queen. That makes me feel like I got a nice little collection of stuff. And I feel like, this is a, maybe these things will raise in value and I'll never sell them because that's the kind of person I am. But frankly, I suspect I'm going to get more use out of Fluffy Quest, right? We're definitely going to review this one next, right?
During this guide I'm magic, on board. You're owed an episode about anything you're enthusiastic about. Absolutely.
Great. You heard it here. 100%. You heard it here, viewers. Coming soon. I'm gonna have to do a little more research. I honestly own this because it was part of the lot that I bought at the auction.
Wild.
Yeah. Okay. Dan, we are just about out of time. Any final thoughts on Blackmore?
There's not a lot here that I use, and there's not a lot that lived that became really integral to D&D. So I'm willing to use the Assassin's Table. I'm warm on that. Some of the aquatic monsters I'm willing to use. The beetles, the fire beetles and giant frogs and giant toads, those actually are pretty well-known in D&D circles. So I like those. I want better underwater rules. I want better disease rules. The hit location was a bad idea, but I'm glad these things were tried. I mean, it was experimental and I'm glad these things were tried and they must've worked for somebody at some time or seemed like a good idea. Yep. Like we say, once in a while, you got to put one on the wall, or maybe for Blackmore, once in a while, you got to take a dunking, and good for you for getting out on the boat and trying to make something new happen. Thumbs up to that.
And you know, the two character classes introduced are classics of the system these days, of the setting, right? Like fifth edition definitely has both monk and assassin in it, right? I'm sure it has monk and assassin.
Maybe it's one of those subclasses of thieves. Is that, do they have assassin? Really? I mean, to be clear, it's routinely removed. I mean, it was removed in second edition, and it wasn't part of third edition. You know, maybe again they have one of these, like, you're a thief, but you have this path you can go on. I mean, it's usually removed, frankly. Most editions yank it at some point, and they're like, oh, you want it back? We can give you a supplement.
Well, perpetually a supplement class.
This is true. This is true. If you like a monk, all is forgiven.
All right. Viewers, if you have opinions on the contents of the Blackmoor supplement, or any thoughts to share in that regard, or you're just very excited to hear more about Fluffy Quest, leave us a comment in the comment section of the YouTube video here. We'd love to hear from you. Help us decide what we should cover next.
Definitely. And of course, remember, you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please look for us there and assassinate that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can find those files on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also listen to us on various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Podcast. If you're listening to us on one of those sites right now and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do, and of course, thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where we're talking about all this kind of stuff 24/7 all the time. And we'll also get you into our live after chat in about 10 minutes after every show so that you can tell us your favorite parts of Blackmoor today and all the little gems that we missed on the show, possibly, that are just things you've got to have in your D&D campaign or you're a bad DM. So we definitely want to hear about that. We'll just like Paul said at the top of the hour, we'd like to see you there. It's always a blast. And of course, don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you.